Hello and welcome to episode 11 of the Racquetball Show. Can't believe we've made it this far already, but in this episode we have some good stuff for you. I bring on Tim Perrigo to talk about Kane's recent announcement that he is 90% sure that he'll be retiring, an announcement he made after a tournament in Sarasota. Then we have an instructional segment where I talk about ways to develop power in your racquetball swing. And finally, I bring on head IRT referee Scott McClellan for a fun and interesting interview. Hope you enjoy episode 11 of the Racquetball Show podcast. Thank you.
It is absolute pandemonium here.
I will be the greatest player to ever play the game.
Anybody who won't dive for it
shouldn't be playing.
Get that ball. Get the ball.
All right, guys. So some of you may have seen the recent announcement that Kane Wasilenchuk had, which is that he is essentially retiring. He's 90% sure that he's retiring, and I brought back on a special guest, Tim Perrigo.
Hey there.
Who I started the podcast with. He hasn't been as available after starting a food truck and everything, but I wanted to get him back on and get his thoughts so we could kind of discuss this announcement.
After I started the cart, I was 90% sure that I wasn't coming back to the podcast, but here I am.
Yeah, and that's, hey, similar to how Kane is doing it. He said he's going to play, a few tournaments a year. This is Perrigo's involvement. He's 90% retired, and he's jumping in for a podcast every once in a while.
Well, doesn't the GOAT in every sport come back for at least 1 to 2 comebacks?
Are you proclaiming yourself to be a GOAT, the GOAT of racquetball podcasting?
No. I'm just saying, in Kane's estimation, I'm sure he's probably got to be thinking, I'm coming back at least once, right? It's like a good rock band. I think got to do at least one encore.
I think he said specifically that. I think he said he'll plan on being back for the U.S. Open to play, spoiler, he said. And, you know, maybe some tournaments that are convenient for him. But, he didn't give specific reasoning, which I thought was interesting, as to why he's retiring. He did say he's not enjoying it as much. But he also said it's not travel related, although it seems, you know, the travel is taking a toll on him. So, yeah, what do you think his reasoning is, if you were to speculate?
That's a good question. And, of course, like, you get into speculation about someone that I don't know, his motivations, his family dynamic, his health, his enjoyment, his competitive spirit, all these different things come into play that I just really can't speak about. But from what we know about Kane, the competitor, and, you know, what he's said more or less in the media, I guess you could say, is that, you know, he just doesn't seem to be, just doesn't seem to have the fire for it anymore. Now, fire can be caused by a good amount of money. I'm sure if he was playing in the NBA, he'd do a few more years for the money. I'm sure if he had an awesome rivalry going on, that could spur him as well to continue to play. But at this point, I don't see any sort of clear motivation for him to keep playing other than to continue to cement his place in the history books.
Yeah, I think so. The reason he's not retiring to me is that, you know, he wants to retire on top is like a reason I've heard, but he's still very much on top. I mean, he lost maybe 1 or 2 games this year. He definitely didn't lose a match. I feel like he could easily go another year or two as the number one player, if not still just undefeated in matches. So, yeah, he could be retiring on top in a couple of years, it seems to me. And, you know, as a fan, also as a player, but just as someone interested seeing, you know, the tour and how it unfolds, I was excited to see, you know, as Kane got older and his body started to break down a little bit, I thought it would be interesting to see him playing some of these up-and-coming guys who are working hard and getting into their peaks as he's dwindling away from his. So,
and as the racquetball fan in me, of course we'd love to see that. You know, who wouldn't? Like, that is, but what is it really worth? I mean, to someone's livelihood, to someone's happiness, it's like there's not the fanfare, there's not the money, there's nothing involved really other than I'm saying I would just like to see this as a fan. So I cannot hold, you know, I do not hold Kane's feet to the fire at all for this decision. It's, you know, fair enough, man. I hate to see him go. That being said, I do hope that you know, he does a comeback tour. That would be cool. It's like people have been criticizing Kane a little bit for his like social media work, his public image, his appearance, and there maybe there is some weight to those allegations. But at the end of the day, this could be his first big media stunt, you know, his first retirement.
Yeah.
Now he's going to come back.
You know, I think it, I don't think it's necessarily a good thing that he retired for the tour and everything, but I do think it makes things a lot more interesting. I thought it was interesting when, I mean, we had like, I'm just kind of guessing here, but I think like 8 different people who won IRT stops this year, which I think that's really cool. When you go into a tournament and it's kind of March Madness, it's, you don't know exactly who's going to win, and it's kind of anybody's tournament. It's a bit more interesting, sure. I think, than when you know Kane's going to come through and dominate a draw. And I think with the idea that Kane will be playing random tournaments here and there, it's also interesting that he's going to come back, maybe not be as polished.
See,
as
that
he
would
has
be
been.
That could be good though,
yeah,
right?
No, totally. I think it'll make for an interesting next few seasons.
Absolutely, and of course there is a beauty, there is a poetic movement to the way Kane played at his peak, and the domination there is something, a sight to behold in itself. We've had a lot of that for many years now. So yeah, this could make things more interesting. You know, it's a trade-off. We're going to lose some of that greatness that we get to witness as fans, but at the same time, we may see things like rivalries form, very competitive matches, and in that sense, you know, that's very exciting stuff for a fan.
Yeah, and to just talk a little bit more about his dominance, I was reading through Todd Boss at Pro Racquetball Stats put out a thing just statistically how dominant Kane was. So he had some examples of these, and he did a great post about it, but 12 Pro Tour titles, 6 more than the next closest competitor, which was Cliff Swain, you know, double anybody else. His tournament win percentage was 68.3%. So, you know, if he Todd says that if his match win-loss percentage, this is his tournament, he won 68% of tournaments. If that was his match win-loss percentage, he'd be in the top 15 players of all time. And he won that many tournaments.
Wow.
Another favorite of mine. So of the 17, of the most dominating tournaments in history, all of the top 17 of them are Kane. You know, you look at how dominant a player was throughout a tournament. The very top 17 were all him. I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah, it is crazy. He's, you know, he found his way to master the field. And in that sense, he is a man of the moment. And he sees, you know, he sees the opportunity in that sense. Invariably, like, these conversations are going to go to who's the greatest player of all time. When you start reading stats like that, people will cite how there was a deeper field back in the 80s and 90s and there's more people playing. They'll say, in some ways, it was harder with the smaller rackets, or, you know, there was no Cliff or Sudsy who were of his caliber, people may argue. And then on the other side, it's like the numbers are so overwhelmingly on Kane's side. Oh, that absolutely. It's hard to say statistically he's anything other than the GOAT, and it's not even close. But one thing that we can say for certain is that, like a Sudsy or Cliff who kind of rose to dominance, Kane figured out how to win, and he was able to figure out how to win in this era. So in this way, he has mastered this era. And what more can it really be asked of a player? You know, we can't comparing someone against history is very interesting. But, you know, it's you're chasing your own tail.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that he had never had a direct competitor and nobody who could completely challenge him and compete with him. But I don't know. It's not the guy's fault. You know, he dominated everybody else. And I think another point is that if Kane just didn't play racquetball, think about the dominance Rocky would have had. Think about how many second place finishes he had. We'd be talking about
him. It changes everything.
The dominant player of a generation, and maybe about him as potentially the greatest.
Or, and I know this is a strange point, but think about other players who saw Kane and like, listen, I'm going to be relegated to be number two, to be sitting where Rocky is, and I'm going to become that banker that I studied for in college. Think about how many people it may have thrown off of professional racquetball. I know that's a strange point, but think about some of the past pros who are no longer here. If Rocky Carson was the number one, there may be some real incentive to be like, hey, I actually could be the best player in the world. Maybe Kane's in some ways, you know.
Yeah, it can definitely be a dream crusher when you're an up-and-coming player and you just dominates you, or when you, you know, you see how dominant he is and you're deciding, should I go for this thing full time when only a handful of players, you know, probably five or less, make enough money to support themselves just on racquetball? Should I go after this thing? Well, it's a challenging task, to say the least. So,
and again, I think that goes back to, you know, Kane cannot be blamed for this decision at all, because, you know, it's basically these guys play because they love the game. They're not playing for the fame and the fortune. They're playing because they have a earnest desire to compete and to win and to be the best racquetball players they can be. And if someone wants to step away from that to focus on other parts of their life, I think that's totally fair. I think that it's Kane's retirement is as much about the state and the sport of racquetball as it is about his own private, you know, feelings on what he wants to do.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'll say just congratulations to Kane on an incredible career. That was, I mean, just so phenomenal to watch. Anytime I go and watch, like, I want to learn how to improve my form, or I want to learn, you know, who should I be emulating, I look at his game. And, you know, he owns all the records in the field. Just, like, a really, really amazing career. It's hard to, it's hard to undersell how awesome he was.
Yeah, what was he the greatest player of all time? That's up for debate, but he certainly was racquetball's greatest champion.
Yeah, I don't think it's even up for debate, but yeah, so thanks for coming on, Perigo. That'll be our news segment for this episode.
Absolutely.
Appreciate it, man, and hopefully we can get more podcasting going in the near future.
Definitely, man. Thanks for having me.
The Racquetball Show is sponsored by Health IQ, an insurance company that helps health-conscious people like runners, cyclists, weightlifters, vegetarians, and racquetball players get lower rates on their life insurance. Health IQ uses science and data to secure lower rates on life insurance for health-conscious people. Health IQ can save customers up to 33% because physically active people have a 56% lower risk of heart disease, 20% lower risk of cancer, and a 58% lower risk of diabetes compared to people who are inactive. Like saving money on your car insurance for being a good driver, Health IQ saves you money on your life insurance for living a health-conscious lifestyle. To see if you qualify, to learn more, or to get a free quote on life insurance, you can visit healthiq.com/TRS. Link in the podcast description. This is a great way of supporting the podcast and of potentially getting great savings on your life insurance. Check them out. Welcome to the instructional segment. This episode is going to be something a lot of people have asked to hear about, which is how to develop power in your racquetball swing. So, a common misconception, and it's not necessarily taught often, but it's a lot of people have the idea that you develop power from the wrist snap or from using your arm. And while it might look that way because you see, you know, the arm looks like the most violently moving part of the chain in your racquetball swing, power is certainly not developed from the arm or the wrist or anything like that. Power comes from your lower body, comes from your legs. And it makes sense because the legs are the biggest, strongest muscles in the body, particularly the quads and the hamstrings. So you want to develop power from the ground up. Now, how do we do this? You should think of the swing as a kinetic chain of movement flowing from your legs all the way into your core, into your shoulder, down into your arm, down into your wrist, finally transferring through the racket into the strings, which powers the ball. And that's a kind of convoluted way of saying that power starts from the ground up as a flowing kinetic chain of movement. Now, it's also better to look at the swing this way from an injury avoidance standpoint. I think when you learn to swing all arm and wrist and just muscle the ball with your upper body, you're much more likely to hurt something, and you see a lot of players with elbow and shoulder injuries for this reason. Now, let's break down a little bit of what you should be doing with your legs and your lower body to help develop this power. So to start with, you are going to create what's called linear motion. So this is essentially, you're going to create motion that's moving forward toward the front wall. And what you're going to want to do to develop that is you're going to want to start with most of your weight on your backside. So obviously, you know, if you're righty hitting a backhand, most of your weight will start on your left side of your body, and a righty hitting a forehand, it'll start on the right, and then just opposite for a lefty. And you're going to want to shift your weight forward and create a large weight transfer. This will then turn into rotational motion. So as your weight starts moving forward, you're going to start rotating your hips. Now, the hip rotation is probably the biggest thing that is going to create the most power. It's going to fire your energy. It's going to allow your core to snap, which will move your shoulder. And then at that point, it's not so much forcing your arm and your forearm and your wrist to... you're not forcing those things to move with strength. Those things will kind of naturally flow through the zone, and you're just firing your muscles a little bit while essentially just stabilizing and making sure that everything is flat with those muscles. It should just feel like those are kind of along for the ride rather than a driving force, that being your upper body. So another thing regarding power is I think there are some metrics you can look at to study your own swing and analyze, both analyze your swing on video and also while you're hitting in real time on the court, what you should be thinking about as far as how can I develop more power. And it should, again, be in kind of a natural way. I don't think you should ever really be forcing power. You should never develop power through trying to muscle your way through it. You know, you can develop strength and through the weight room in both your legs and your core and your upper body. But you shouldn't ever think of power as I need to be stronger to develop more power. I think it's more of a mechanical issue. You can develop power through better mechanics rather than through strength. It will have more bang for your buck at the very least. So I like to think of metrics. I read this book when I was really into baseball called Positional Hitting by Jaime Ceballos. And he would look at different, basically, angles that hitters would be making. And by analyzing angles at different steps through their swing, he would be able to analyze which players would have the most power and the most success hitting. So a few metrics, for example, that he used were basically the angle that your forearm to your upper arm made relative to each other at impact. He looked at the area of impact that you had with your swing, so how long was your bat in the zone along which a pitch would be through that plane. So you can look at these metrics in your racquetball swing too. When you're breaking it down, both on the court or on video after the fact, you can look at some things that will help you determine where you might be not getting your full potential out of your swing in terms of power. So some of these metrics, in my opinion, are the hip turn. So looking at the rotation of your hips from right before you start your swing to the finish of your swing, you could kind of measure that angle. And if you look at the great players, especially, I mean, if you look at Kane, his hips are, they start back or not even necessarily parallel to the sidewall, but even a little bit away from the front wall. And then he is fully rotating really quickly and facing the front wall after he finishes his swing. And it's this hip rotation that I think counts for why he is so powerful. And he's able to do that even when he's a little bit off balance. Another thing you can look at is loading. So right before you take your swing, you're going to do what's called loading. And this might not necessarily be something that you think about consciously, but it's a term that comes from baseball for me. And loading essentially means what are you doing with your body such that it is ready to just fire. Your body, you are bringing your arm back, you are essentially having all the muscles ready to fire like a rubber band rather than having your muscles less ready to fire. all your weight should be back again. In this loading position, basically everything should be, you should essentially practice, what is my loading position like? What is my body, what is the position of my body right before I fire into my swing? And how can I make it such that my muscles are more ready to fire? How can I make it such that my hips are turned a little bit further away from that front wall so that I can rotate into the ball? How can my weight be a little bit further back? These are things to look at with the load. Now, weight transfer is another big metric you can look at. How much weight am I transferring? We talked about how you want to start with linear movement into that rotational movement. So weight transfer, how could I be transferring more weight? And then finally, vector of force. So when I do impact the ball, what is the exact direction in which I'm impacting the ball? Am I slicing it such that while I want to be hitting the ball on a down the line, for example, I want to be hitting the ball perfectly straight? Is my vector of force actually not straight? Am I losing some power in the sense that I'm not perfectly hitting the ball in the direction that I want to be hitting it? So these are all things to look at. And I say this with an important caveat. You can look at weight transfer as much as you want, but your swing still needs to be balanced and it needs to be smooth and accurate and graceful, essentially. You shouldn't be sacrificing balance in the interest of getting better weight transfer, for example. You might get amazing weight transfer by the book if you start fully on your back foot and then hop right all onto your front foot, but that's not a balanced swing. So practice all these things, do them all, but with the caveat that the swing should still be comfortable and you should still be ready to pounce onto the next shot. You should still be in a good position with your body in a good athletic stance, ready to move to the next ball, and everything should be fluid and comfortable. It might not be comfortable at first, but everything should look smooth and comfortable. And that's a big caveat in developing power. You want everything to still be smooth and comfortable. So hopefully this helps in developing power with your swing. Develop that power with your legs. You want linear motion into rotational motion. You want things to be a kinetic chain of movement, starting with the small muscles down at the ground and then moving into, you know, the wrist and the things that connect with the racket. And some metrics you can look at are the hip turn, the hip rotation, loading, weight transfer, and your vector of force. So I hope this helps, guys. Reach out to me if you have any questions. I love to talk about these things, and I'm always curious to know what you guys are interested in learning about. So hit me up, Dylan@racquetballshow.com, DYLAN@racquetballshow.com, if you're interested in learning more. Thank you. Before getting into my interview with Scott, I wanted to quickly plug my sponsor, Gearbox Sports. Now, as I'm sure many of you, since you're in the racquetball community, know, Gearbox is a provider of all things racquetball, all your racquetball needs. They provide rackets, gloves, eye guards, bags, etc. And I wanted to plug Gearbox because they do a phenomenal job. Now, obviously, full disclosure, I am sponsored by them, but I chose them for a reason. I think they do a phenomenal job. All their gear is amazing. I've never had any complaints with any of the gear. And it's always been top-of-the-line stuff. I've always thought that their rackets and all their products work great and are super comfortable for me. And their team of people is great. They're always awesome with customer support and everything like that. So if you are in the market for anything racquetball, if you need new rackets or gloves or eye guards, I would highly suggest going to Gearbox Sports. They're not only amazing products, but also they're people who care a lot about the sport and are doing great things to help it grow. If you're interested in checking them out, just go to gearboxsports.com and you can look at all their products there or reach out to support@gearboxsports.com and you can talk to the Gearbox team. So I'm here with head IRT referee, University of Texas Austin head coach, and professional player Scott McClellan. Scott, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I wanted to start out just kind of asking you about your lifestyle. It seems to me like a really cool lifestyle. You are a software engineer and then also play professionally and are also the head referee, so it's able to kind of pay for your travels. How'd you get into that, and how awesome is it? Is it as cool as it sounds?
Yeah, you know, it took a little while to get to like to the point where I could do something like this. Like in the work that I do, I do programming professionally. It's a full time job. So I did like the going into work for the first like 5 years of my software career, and then got to the point where I had enough trust where I could I could work from anywhere. And so that was definitely like a chosen like path for me. And it's like really enabled me to be like part of racquetball like professionally. Cause I think if I had a job that I had to go in and like needed to take full time off to play tournaments, I don't think I'd be able to do that. So you might see me at events like with the laptop out, like doing programming while like, you know, casually watching a racquetball match or something. So that's kind of how it's evolved. But I have huge respect for my employer for appreciating productivity over just like time spent, which is awesome.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, you might see Scott doing his programming, and you might also see him playing chess on his computer. I've seen both.
That's also very true.
Yeah.
Yeah. Feel free to come up and challenge me to chess if you play chess.
If you want to get embarrassed. So Scott, you're the head referee of the IRT. What has that experience been like?
Yeah. So when I first started playing, like I was just traveling around, and I like to watch a lot of like pro matches. So I think that's what initially like drew me to reffing, because I wanted to go to these tournaments. I wanted to watch all the top matches, and you know, sometimes you can't find seats at the matches. So what better way to get close to the game than reffing? So that's kind of how I got started with the reffing. I just kind of looked for a way to like make a little bit more money while I was traveling. So it wasn't just like a net loss, specifically just for like the travel expenses and everything. So the reffing kind of helps offset some of that. But yeah, the experiences can definitely vary.
Yeah.
I think there are certain characteristics that I have that I'd say just make it easier for me to deal with some of the stress that other players might experience. But it can definitely be very stressful because players have a lot on the line sometimes.
Yeah, interesting. I was going to ask you about that. It seems like reffing can be an exercise in, you know, just discomfort tolerance. People are constantly yelling at you. How has that experience been? How do you kind of manage dealing with, because you're kind of a verbal punching bag a lot of the times. So how do you deal with that?
Yeah, you know, it's kind of interesting because like I have like my boundaries. So like any like personal insults, I'm like instantly going to call technical. So like that's a firm boundary. In terms of just like yelling and players disagreeing, like fans disagreeing, like kind of the more important thing is that like the players understand the calls, because like the fans are going to be booing no matter what. Like, I mean, like if they, something happens that they don't like, they're going to boo. But like, as long as the players can understand the call, that's like the arena where I'm more concerned. Like, I just want the players to know like what my reasoning is for all that. And so, yeah, like knowing that like their yelling isn't about me is like a big thing. Like, you know, they might be screaming in rage, like that a call didn't go their way, but you know, that's them being frustrated. And some players definitely use that as a strategy. Like they'll try to get outside the court, basically just to like take their mind off the game, or just like deflect what they're feeling. Like that they might be like feeling really upset themselves, and it's not productive to display that on the court. So I think they sometimes redirect that to me.
I was wondering, As a referee, you've seen many other people jump into the refereeing game who aren't necessarily professional, who don't have any training in it of any sort. What common mistakes do you see people making when they referee?
Yeah, there are a few things. One is kind of being indecisive. Like they will kind of flounder, like they might like think they know a call and try to stop play, but be kind of passive about it. And then like play keeps going, and then like they didn't learn from like the mistake, because like player kept going, and like just like being clear and being loud about like what you're seeing, and what like stopping play like louder is definitely like a big thing. And like I guess the other end of that spectrum is like talking too much with the players, like instead of just like saying what the call is and what the action is, and like kind of sticking to that and like just being firm about, like, yeah, a lot of it's like firmness. It's kind of the theme with these. It's just like the purpose or the job of the ref is just to keep the game flowing, keep the players in line, make sure that like the game keeps its pace. And so the what I've found is the best way to do that is just being like clear and then holding the boundary.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. Is there any particular call you see people messing up consistently?
The
voidable hinder call?
Avoidable hinders are definitely a thing, and they're like they're technical definitions for those things, like that it's hard for amateur players to really understand. But yeah, like the hardest thing I think, or like the grayest area right now in reffing is with around screen serves, where like there's the thought of like, oh, you know, it was a setup and I like took the setup, and, you know, it shouldn't be a screen. And like, I mean, honestly, like the rule book doesn't say anything about like the setup. So the way that I handle that, and the way that I handle any of like gray area that I like perceive in the rule book, I have like a list of talking points that I'll go over with the players before the match. So I'll talk about like screens. I'll talk about like rack it up before you serve. It's, you know, if it's just a replay, if the player serves, I'll talk about jumping and like whether that's, you know, you can get a penalty hinder still. So I have like five or so of these points that I just kind of go through. But yeah, like clearing those before the match makes it way easier, because then like, I mean, they're agreeing to play like based on that, like those rules. So like I like to nip it before it can turn into a, you know, 10-minute conversation when someone walks off the court and like explain what a screen serve is.
I like the way you kind of set up those things, because yeah, those are probably the most argued about points. One of my pet peeves is when a referee will come in and say, "Hey guys, just so you know, I'm gonna do my best. Don't yell at me, you know. Just don't get mad at me." And it's like you can't argue with my calls because I'm gonna do my best. I feel like that's so common, and it always cracks me up.
It's like setting yourself up for defeat. It's like, yeah, you're gonna yell at me, but you know, just don't.
Yeah, I'm not going to be very good. Just heads up. So another thing I'd like to talk about, you seem to me at least to have pretty rapidly, or you kind of started late in life with racquetball. Did you started in high school? Is that correct?
Yeah, I did start playing in high school. So I played really competitively through the program in Salem, Oregon.
Yeah.
So I originally grew up in Oregon, played through the high school program there. And then I went to college and like played a little bit, but like the community in San Antonio where I went to school, I didn't really find like the like active players. So there are some there that I learned later, but didn't have a car on campus, et cetera, et cetera. So kind of stayed at the same level, and then happened to find myself in Austin, which is like a really good spot for racquetball, like a lot of good players. So yeah, like after that like waiting period that I could have got a lot stronger, I think, like during collegiate age, I kind of like maintained the same skill level. And then like only recently, or like the last 2 or 3 years, have I been like kind of pushing my game a lot more.
Yeah. So what do you think has allowed you to have that rapid improvement?
I think that's, that would be playing with Kane quite a bit. I finally got some court time with Kane around 3 years ago. And so since then I've been like sparring a bit. Like it's never like really serious games or anything, but there's a group of guys who all kind of play. So having access to like, you know, the top player on the tour and like being able to play against him every now and then, is definitely one of the biggest things. Like, and I'd say honestly that that's probably helped my reffing more than anything else. Just being able to see like his drive serve, or like see like the shots that he's hit at the speed he's hitting them. Like, I don't think there are many players on the tour that can hit like that fast or faster shots. So like seeing the ball doing that, I have a very up close view of like what the ball does with different spins and different different things. So it's kind of like a practice area for reffing, almost, just like being on the court with a player of that caliber. So
yeah, one of the things I noticed, just having played you a couple times, you were disproportionately good at returning serves against another player of your skill level. I feel like I'll get some aces in here or there, but when I'm playing a guy who's consistently facing Kane's drive serve, it's like I'm never gonna ace him.
Yeah, and that alone has worked my footwork for returning serve, really snap that down, because you can't misstep, otherwise you're not gonna get the serve. So
yeah,
that's a good observation.
So what is the experience of playing with Kane like?
Yeah, so I will say he tries a lot of really interesting things, I'll say. Really obscure shots and everything. I think it's something to me, I think he just has fun playing the game. We play a lot of doubles, so I get to know different sides better than others. I don't really know how to describe it. I just get to anticipate certain shots more than others, and it's like I acclimate more to that level of play than lower levels. So I might lose to players that I think I should be beating. But then I'll play way more competitive matches against better players sometimes. So that's kind of a trend that I've noticed with playing on the tour a bit, is that I have some really strong games against other players that are very strong players. I've had some good ones against Jose Rojas and a few others, but that's one thing I noticed. He doesn't help with getting setups. He helps with the very difficult high risk shots. It helps me hone those shots down.
Yeah, gotcha. Yeah, you're more used to facing the 180 mile an hour drive serve than you are to having a setup 10 feet from the front wall.
Yep. Got it. Exactly. Yeah.
So having observed his practice style, what does he do training wise that's made him so dominant?
I don't know a ton about his training routines. I think he just has a more business approach to it than a lot of the other players do. He'll try different things, or just he'll have an idea about something and then just try doing it and experiment more. He's more, I guess, deliberate about what he's practicing than other people are. And he'll craft things specifically to work on backhands, or specifically to work on forehands, or agility, footwork, foot speed, etc. So yeah, it's definitely not a specific thing I've heard many of the podcasts say.
Sure. Yeah. You don't see any of the background of what he does on his own, kind of conditioning wise or training wise?
Not really. He's not super secretive about it. When I get time with him, it's mostly just to play either singles or doubles or something. So, I train with him or anything like that. So
gotcha.
I don't have a whole, an insight into how that Willy Wonka machine works, so to speak.
Yeah. I was hoping you'd spill all the secrets, Scott. What the heck?
That's for him to do.
I'm sure it's just one tiny little trick you'd tell us, and then all of a sudden we'd all be as good as he is.
It's one weird trick to pick up racquetball. All the coaches hate that.
Yeah. 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 That's how I got to start online marketing my podcast and such.
One weird trick to win all your racquetball games.
So on the coaching side, you're the coach of the University of Texas Austin team. They've developed a pretty good team, it seems to me. How has that experience been?
Yeah. So I started doing that when I moved to Austin about 5 years ago. I'd say the club's kind of stayed around the same level, maybe grown a little bit, but I think, it's been really fun. This last I guess a couple of weeks ago, I went to the Collegiate Nationals with them. I've done that a few years now. So yeah, I mean, the team has a wide array of like players and talents and everything. And, I'll say that it's more like a community than it is like a regimented drill kind of club, which is kind of interesting coming from like a high school program that was really regimented.
Interesting. Yeah. I think, honestly, I think your high school was kind of unique in that way. I don't think a lot of high schools drill in a regimented way.
I mean a lot of props to give to Sprague High School, and specifically Ryan Edmiston gave me a lot of help with he was a high level open player, and like he definitely like pushed the bar for like how much we could work on stuff. And like practices were split. We'd have like the new players, the casual players at one practice, and then like the people who are there to do like a mile before you do drills, and then you do like specifically footwork, and then you play like set matches where like you're told who to play, and like if you skip the ball, like from this section you do 5 push-ups, this section you do 10 push-ups, etc. Skip a serve, you do 20 push-ups, stuff like that. And then like at the end you do all the like conditioning stuff. So yeah, like the practices were really structured in high school, and like I think that's one of the reasons that I'm like still so like in like really interested in the game. Like it kind of showed me how much depth you could really get into by playing the sport. So
yeah, that's awesome. On the IRT side of things, so you were have been the head referee since, you know, Menino was the IRT commissioner, and then recently John Scott and Andy Kolbak have taken over the tour. What have your thoughts been on that change? Are you enjoying the way that the IRT has made some changes?
Yeah, definitely. I want to give some props to Andy for like, he's definitely like taken all the details and like really honed things in. Like, it seems like things are like really moving along well, and like tournaments, like I have, being the head ref, I have way less to worry about. Like I used to like need to worry about finding refs for the first matches of each day. Now I just show up, do the reffing, done. And like, yeah, he's made that a lot easier. On the tour side, I'm also like really excited to see like some of the changes that John's been making, like improving stream quality, improving like commentary, adding the features division, and like just trying some different things, like things that had been kind of, I guess I could say, it's like stagnant or like kind of staying at the same level. So I think there are a lot of influences that have kind of pushed that along. Like the new investors have definitely been a big push for that. But I like the changes I'm seeing. I actually like the switch to the 15 points, 15, 11, like for the most part. I've mixed thoughts on it, but I do like it, especially from a reffing perspective.
Great. Yeah. I've thought they've done a great job of just any change that they see as this could potentially be beneficial, just going after it. And even things maybe like the 2 games 15 tiebreaker 11, maybe that doesn't work out as well as they would have liked, but just trying new things and seeing if they work and just being quick to implement things, I've been happy with what I've seen from those, from John and Andy as the IRT commissioners. So next, yeah, I'd like to talk a little bit about just ideas for growing the sport. Obviously, you know, racquetball is not, I think, at a level most people would like it to be from a participation standpoint. What would be some ideas you have to help grow racquetball in general?
Yeah, I think I heard that like bits of this mentioned in a different podcast, but I think the main thing for me is having a more concentrated product of like specifically really strong like replays or really, really strong recaps of a match. Like what I could see is like having someone at the end of each match that's streamed, go through and just like take clips of like different things that are happening, like with the scoreboard included, just like you see with like the highlights reel in, you know, in the Sports Center, when they go through a game and say like, here's a, and like a moment where momentum swung or something like that. I think like chopping up rallies usually aren't too long, so you can definitely like chop up and say like, here's a good rally, here's a good rally. Right now it seems like the approach is like, here's one rally, let's just send that off and then do the highlight, like, you know, try to get that on SportsCenter, which is good too. But I'd love to see like a match recap, like just like a 2 minute, like maybe narrated, just talking over like what's going on. I think from a tourist perspective, that would like really like boost viewership and like boost engagement. Cause you could see like if I want to know what's going on with the tournament, but it's in like the semis, I wanted to know like what happened with the players. Right now I have to watch kind of the whole match or like skip around or something. So it's like, it'd be a good way to boost that visibility. And I think pushing that would still, incentivize players who are interested to watch the whole match. So as far as like funding a person who goes through and does that, I don't know.
Yeah.
Like I would love to see like some sort of internship or something, or like even like $1 on the entry fee goes to some, I don't know. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. If there are any volunteers out there.
Yeah. Yeah. If you're interested in building racquetball replays, feel free to reach out to, I guess me or John or
whomever.
Maybe we can make that work.
Yeah. That, I think that would be outstanding. I'm about as racquetball junky as they come, and I know other people in this same boat, and I feel like I don't have enough time to watch every single match. I love that we're doing a great job of posting, you know, pretty much every match is free, streamed online, or accessible through IRT Network. But, you know, not everybody has the time to watch an entire match. I think having it packaged as highlight reels after a tournament would be a great way of building engagement. So, yeah, I really like what we have to say there.
Yeah, so that's kind of on the pro side. I think that's something that might be one avenue we could go. On like the amateur side, I think this exists, but it's really hard to find. Like, I would like to know, like, if I'm in a random city, where the racquetball clubs are, like which places even have racquetball. Like, I can pull up Google Maps and search for it, but like, if I want to know like where the racquetball clubs are, where they meet, maybe I live in like somewhere in Arizona or something, like what are the clubs near me that have racquetball and how can I get connected to those? Like, I think that's a question that someone who happens to see racquetball might want to learn. Like, for example, for me, I'd love to like play badminton or something, but like, I don't know a place to do that. So like, yeah, I wouldn't even know like where to start looking. So I'd love to see just like a, something on like a racquetball website to be able to see where all the clubs are and who the contacts are for those clubs.
Yeah, I agree. I think it would be super beneficial. Just, I think people are relatively used to that online, in the sense that you can just Google something and there'll be an answer. So when it comes to racquetball and it's difficult to, I think if it were easy, where you look up, okay, there's a court 5 miles away from me, and I know that it has this league system, and here's the tournament director who says he's happy to hook me up with like a racket I can use to try out, and then I'll buy one later. If you had that, all that information at the, you know, snap of your fingers, which we do in a lot of other areas online, I think that would be huge. So,
yeah. I mean, racquetball is not as ubiquitous as tennis or basketball or, you know, even soccer. Like, so there are all these sports that like you can find local things to do. I think it's because it's harder to find racquetball courts around. I think that would be like the improving the discoverability of courts is one great avenue, I think.
Totally. Yeah. And I think neither of those suggestions are cheap things necessarily, but I think they would be great investments. I don't know who would be able to put up the capital to be able to do that, but I think a lot of the things I see money being put into look to me not necessarily like long-term plays that help growth overall. They seem like, oh, they'll help this particular region and it might crumble in 5 years. So I think doing things like that would build long-term would be awesome.
Well, what I have in mind is more like a Wikipedia page ish, something like that. Just like a wiki page that anybody can edit and add their own club, and then just like start passing out the word like at all the main events to say like, if you run a club, add your information to this like community maintained page, and like kind of like crowdsource that like get everyone's club to be like added on there. So I don't see it as like a really expensive thing. Like,
okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like that. I think that's smart. That's why we need that's why I invite a computer scientist on. So Scott, do you have a good racquetball story that you could share from your years in the sport?
Let's see. So I do have several involving players misbehaving. But just to, you know, protect the guilty, I will not share those stories. So instead, I'll talk about a time that I messed up, which was, it was at the start of the season, the first tournament, which was in LA. It was a match between, I think it was Kane and Andre Perea. And I think it was, I can't remember which game it was. I think it was game two or game three. We were about halfway through. It was like 7-3. And like Kane was serving. There was a timeout called. They walked off the court. My brain just like switched off. I just like completely like lost the context of what was going on with the game, grabbed a new ball or like asked John for a new ball and like walked on the court. And like, you know, Kane was getting ready to serve cause we were just getting, you know, getting going again. And I gave him a new ball. He's like, no, this one's fine. And then like, oh, okay. Okay. So I took the ball back and I got back to my, you know, I didn't even look at the card. I was just like, zero serving zero. And Kane looks back at me and Andre looks back and I think they were just dumbstruck. And then, yeah, I think I like my face turned red and I like looked at the card like, oh, whoops. So yeah. And, I think that was probably the most embarrassing thing that I've done, from like a reffing perspective, but, yeah, I felt pretty red in the face for like, I think the rest of that match.
That's great. I had a similar experience where Kane, I was actually reffing Kane in Portland, and he was just dominating somebody. I don't remember who, but he came back from a timeout and he's like, did you get that point before I called the timeout? And I was like, yeah, I couldn't honestly remember, but I thought I did.
Yeah. I've had, yeah.
Yeah. They keep you honest.
I've missed one or two of those, maybe. But I'm pretty good about it now, especially around appeals, where like I scratch a point before I do the appeal, and then I reverse the point, like things like that. Like there are definitely ways that points can be lost that I'm like now getting very direct, like making sure that I don't slip up and accidentally like make someone play to 16 now instead.
Yeah, it just takes somebody yelling at you a couple times, and
yeah,
it imprints it in your brain.
Amount of shaming.
Yeah. So a couple other things you're known for, Scott, are two things: the plum pants and the one look McClellan. How have those built your brand as a referee?
you gotta have some way to sell whatever referees are there to sell. But yeah, the tight plum pants, I like to wear like kind of professional looking clothing. I think like it's not at all like required for the position, but I like to like, I think professionalism has to start like somewhere, and like that's all I can control is like how I dress. So like I try to keep a high standard, but I was wearing like, you know, slacks that were like, you know, plum colored, and I think John Scott made a comment something like he's scurrying up the stairs in those tight plum pants, and it stuck. And now I make sure to bring them to every to every event. So that's definitely a thing. And then the one look wonder.
That's right.
Yeah, like I take pride in like being very objective when I'm looking at a replay, which is very like, to me, is like the most important thing. And like, I don't care if I, like when I'm watching the replay, I don't really care if I got the call right or wrong. Like I want to get it right at that moment. Like looking at the appeal. So, so yeah, like I sometimes like, it's just very clear. Like I spent most of my, like, I've watched a lot of racquetball, and like, I'd say probably about half of that has been in person. I used to just pore over like all of the archives for like every match that was going on in like the Pro Tour. So like I am very used to seeing ball, like you know, the ball on the screen and like different bounces mean different things and all that, like just off what I see on the screen. So, sometimes if I see a replay and it's positioned right, holler out to Kelly and the team for queuing it up right, so I can see it at the right pace and everything. But sometimes I can just get a quick look and like it's really obvious. And in those cases, don't want to waste any time. One look will do.
Nice, I like it. Yeah, the NFL could learn a lesson from you.
Oh man, if they had like full on timeouts where like they submit it to like an office in New York or something, so that they can like have them review it and be completely removed, that'd be cool.
Yeah, I'm sure that'll happen soon, Scott. I'm sure.
Might be a long process.
If you had one tip for a beginning level or intermediate level racquetball player, what would it be to improve their game?
Yeah, so this is going to be a little bit hard to use words to describe, but I got a lot of this from Fran Davis, so I have to give a lot of credit to Fran.
Yeah.
But basically, like, always setting up so that you, like, regardless of what shot you're going to hit, that you're facing the front wall, or that you're hitting it as if you're hitting a straight shot to the front wall. So if I want to hit a pinch to the left side, I'll hit the ball. Like, let's say I'm hitting a forehand, I'm a right-handed player. If I want to hit a pinch to the left side, I'm actually just going to drop the ball or make contact with the ball later in my swing. So I'm going to like put it around where my front foot is, my front left foot. So I'm going to drop the ball and hit it that late in my swing so that my racket has the right angle to be able to hit toward that wall. And then if I want to hit straight in, I drop it, you know, kind of right in front of me. If I want to hit it so that it hits the right wall first, I'm still a right-handed player hitting a forehand. If I want it to hit the right wall first, I'll drop it more to the right, so that like I make contact earlier in my swing. My racket face is kind of more open to the right. And I think like that one tip has like really shaped how I move to the ball. Because like if a ball's like going short in the court, I have to decide if, you know, what shot I'm going to hit, and it'll be a lot easier to hit that shot if I position myself so that I hit the ball late in my swing or early in my swing. So, I'd say that's one thing that's really helped improve my accuracy for like all of those shots. And something that I don't hear like referenced all that much. So, that's one tip that I really like sharing with newer players. So,
yeah, great. I think that's a big deception thing too. I mean, I think you see, especially if you watch Kane's game, but really any professional, the way they set up to hit the ball, you can't tell where they're going with it. You can't tell if it's a pinch to the left, if it's a cross court, if it's a down line. So, yeah, not only just kind of setting yourself up for success with where you can hit the ball, but also deceiving your opponent is huge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because like regardless of how you're hitting it, you're still setting up the same way. The only difference is where you set yourself in, like relative to the ball.
Yeah.
So.
Well said. Good tip. All right, Scott. Yeah, thanks so much for coming on. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks. I want to give a shout out to my sponsor, Prokenex, and Mike Martinez. Really appreciate like the support that they've given me to do the tour. Because I think when I started out, I had some kind of secondhand equipment, and that was really like making it harder for me to play at a high level. So really want to like thank him and thank the team for the excellent gear. I can't give enough praise for like the rackets, the gloves, and the backpack specifically, just the random things that I really like about it.
Awesome, man. Yeah, thanks a lot, Scott.
All right, yeah, and thank you, Dylan, for your time and for like the platform that you're building with this podcast.
Cool. Do it for the people.
Thanks everyone for listening to episode 11 of the Racquetball Show podcast. I always appreciate you tuning in. If you've been with me through all these episodes, I am greatly appreciative. As always, you can reach out at dylan@racquetballshow.com if you want to email me to ask me any questions or to give feedback on what you think about the show, if you think maybe there's things we should be doing differently or different things you'd like to hear about. So that's dylan@racquetballshow.com. Again, thanks a ton for listening. I really appreciate it.